75 years after independence, the question remains. Has India really shaken up its colonial past? Kerala shows how decolonization became a blueprint for progress. Decolonization isn't just a word here. It's a battle fought, a future rebuilt. Kerala led the way. And Kerala's own Member of Parliament is here to show us how. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Nice to see you, Ranjan.
Nice to see you too.
Oh.
What question is it called? Vaishti or Mund?
This is called a Munda.
Ah. Guys, if they're ready, we'll quickly roll.
Action.
From the heart of Kerala, a politician with unmatched charisma, Dr. Shashi Tharoor. Welcome again.
Thank you. That's very kind. Thank you, Ranjan.
Kerala, they started big land reforms early on from the 1957 to fix what semi-feudal systems were left behind by the British. Was that really a kickstart of decolonization in its true sense?
In many ways, yes. I mean, don't forget that the British tried to replicate in India the sort of squirearchy of the home counties, which is what they wanted all over the country. It started off with the permanent settlement of Bengal in 1790s, was to create a situation where instead of lots of people having lots of land, you would have big zamindars who then you would have a relationship with. So it was easier for colonial control, there were fewer people to deal with. And then the burden of controlling the riotous peasants and masses below was with them. So many of these zamindars often didn't bother to be farmers themselves. They owned the land, they controlled it, but they had tenant farmers doing all the labor. They collected a certain tribute from them. They paid taxes on the basis of that, et cetera, et cetera. And so the squires, as it were, that you saw in England, the equivalents were the zamindars, the big feudal lords in India and in Pakistan, for that matter. Now, what happened was that when independence came, even the Congress Party and the constitution makers had talked about abolition of zamindari and trying to have land reform. But there was much more resistance. And then land being a state subject, the state governments had to find the political will in each state to be able to really conduct serious land reform. There were sort of movements in different states, but nothing thoroughly extensive until Kerala came around. In fact, the Gandhian leader Acharya Vinoba Bhave was famous for his Bhudan campaign, where he basically went to the big rich landlords and urged them to give some of their land to the poor. Bhudan. Bhu is land and dan is giving. Now, that kind of thing is not quite land reform by law. It is counting on the charity of the rich. Kerala, in 1957, elected a communist government, the first ever democratically elected communist government anywhere in the world. And having come to power, they said, we are going to actually implement land reform seriously. And the result in a series of laws culminating in 1969, so it took time, was to dramatically slash land holdings in that everyone who owned significant chunks of land suddenly found it being taken away and rewritten in the names of the tenants. So the tenants who used to farm the land and come and give you the crop and give you the tribute, suddenly they were the owners and you were out. That became the transformation for many people. Now, in many ways, this is a very pioneering venture. Some would argue that even though there have been subsequent successful attempts at land reform in other states, nothing has matched the extensive nature of Kerala's land reform. So that's number one. Number two, because it meant that lots of relatively or formerly poor people suddenly had an economic asset in the form of land, you were able to create economic empowerment up the chain a bit. Third, the kind of socially hierarchical system of colonialism, where everything was top down, where the British dealt with the zamindars, who dealt with the next level, and, you know, that kind of top-down hierarchical economic and social order, that suddenly became dismantled. And in Kerala, therefore, you saw much more participatory democracy. You saw people empowered, and there were a number of reforms that came along in parallel. Let me not say it's only land reform. Land reform was one key to it. There was definitely education, which preceded communist rule. In fact, the very first place in the entire world to decree universal, compulsory, and free primary education for both boys and girls was Kerala, Travancore, when a queen, Rani Gauri Parvathibai, did this in 1817. You now had people who were also educated. They were also economically empowered. Some of them had land. And now you were ending up with greater community participation and development. All of these things were happening in parallel. Education, land reform, more community participation, and thereby a greater emphasis, not on what the rulers wanted as in the colonial era, but on what the people needed. So much more emphasis on healthcare, much more emphasis on hospitals, much more emphasis on reading and spreading of literacy and books and so on. And the Kerala model, as it began to be called, became an absolute paragon. I remember writing a book in 1996-97, published in 97, called India from Midnight to the Millennium, in which I have a section in which I talk about the Malayali miracle, comparing the human development and social development indicators of Kerala with those of the United States. Literacy rate, Kerala is higher. Number of sort of nurses per head of population, Kerala is higher. Number of hospital beds, they're both about equal. Number of doctors, America may be slightly higher, but not much more. Number of newspapers per head of population, Kerala was then about equal, today it's higher because American newspapers are folding. You go through each of these indicators and literacy, education, college degrees, empowerment to women, maternal mortality, infant mortality. Kerala was in every respect comparable to the United States, except Kerala had a tiny per capita income and the United States had 22 times the per capita income of Kerala.
So the people on the internet are confused. While they say land reforms happened, then education you mentioned, also a migration to the Middle East.
Migration
and beyond.
Was a significant.
Who's the real, or courtesy, what is the real success?
Combination of all these factors. Let's take migration, for example. Why was migration possible? Because people were educated. So they could claim jobs that required them to be able to read and write, often not just in their own mother tongue, Malayalam, which is no use in the Gulf, but in English. They had that. So these educated Malayalis grabbed jobs, which perhaps others from other parts of India were not qualified to take because they were not as educated. Literacy and education then facilitated migration. Then what happens with migration? You go into countries where they don't want you to settle down permanently. They don't want to make you citizens. Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Dubai, UAE, all of these places. You went, you worked, and eventually you were meant to retire and leave. So your investment was back in Kerala. When you worked there, you sent your money back to Kerala. And that money then created two things. Number one, it created a sort of a middle class, if you like, an economically empowered middle class in Kerala without necessarily links to either land or social hierarchy. Secondly, and this is possibly a negative, the money became spent in lifestyle consumption, building or improving your house, buying yourself assets you couldn't afford earlier, conspicuous consumption of lifestyle. But it became a disincentive to invest in industry and local job creation and growing businesses. Why would you need to do all that when you can just send someone off to the Gulf and he'll make the money and send it back to you? And don't forget the depreciation of the rupee during the last few decades meant that whatever money you earned abroad, it was usually worth much more in terms of purchasing power back in India. So all of these factors came in.
And Kerala's model of participatory government, like you just mentioned, it's often seen as a fresh, decolonized way of running democracy. Is that the reason why we see less poverty there?
That's certainly part of the case. There's a lot to be said for for why Kerala got away with what it did and how effectively it got away with it. But definitely part of it was participatory democracy, including local level planning. Kerala, for example, strengthened the Panchayati Raj system as soon as they could. You know, the Panchayati Raj amendments were passed in the early 90s. By 1996, Kerala was heavily giving large amounts of money to the panchayat so they could choose their own priorities and allocate the money for them. To this day, in many parts of India, that is not true. In fact, what is happening is state governments are controlling the money, and state government appointed bureaucrats are the ones who are actually making the decisions rather than the local representatives. In Kerala, the local representatives were empowered. So that became a major factor. Educated people also are easier to communicate with. So, for example, when you have something like the COVID pandemic, messaging becomes very easy. A curious thing about Kerala, which I think is something the rest of India will find difficult to fully appreciate, is that all these social reform movements we talked about earlier, social reform movements combined with literacy and therefore political ideologies that we could broadly describe as progressive, also meant that there was a greater sense of egalitarianism in the society. The highest minimum wages in India are in Kerala because labor unions were strong. The working class was able to demand their rights and usually were literate enough to demand it knowledgeably, and they were able to win it. Similarly, when you've got people in an egalitarian society, the concept of service versus the colonial concept of hierarchy changes. Give you an example. During COVID, you remember there was a lockdown. In the lockdown, people had to stay at home. They were not allowed to go out to the streets, go to the shops and so on. What happens if you have no one? Kerala being a place where lots of people have migrated, what happens if you're an old woman, for example? Your son is working in the Gulf. He's not married or his wife has gone with him, whatever it may be. You've got no one at home to bring you any provisions. What happens? You know what happened in Kerala? The police went and got the old lady the provisions and came to her doorstep and gave it to her. You never saw this in any other state in India, but you could see it in Kerala. So some of these experiences make Kerala a bit of an outlier in a good way for the rest of India. In some things, it's bad. What's bad? There is a feeling that Keralites are far too conscious of their rights and not enough conscious of their duties, so that employers are reluctant to open big industries or even businesses which employ lots of people because they're afraid red flags will come, unions will go up, lots of money will be demanded, productivity will be low, etc. Now, the irony is these same Keralites, when they go to foreign countries, are the most sought-after workers. They're smart, they're educated, they know what they're doing, they work well. The tragedy is, why doesn't this happen in Kerala? But that's a totally different debate. Similarly, the immigration problem is now transforming in a very worrying way. The immigration we talked about a few minutes ago was mainly to countries like the Gulf, which is never permanent migration. What is happening in the 21st century is that suddenly there is immigration of particular groups of people to Western countries where immigration is very different, where it can be permanent. For example, Kerala is India's laboratory for nurses. We generate more nurses than every other state in the country put together. We have nursing colleges, nursing training colleges, hospitals. Besides, because the healthcare system is so much more developed, there are more nurses coming out of Kerala. And that's true of any state in India. But now these Kerala nurses are being sought after avidly by America, by Germany, by France, by the UK. All these countries have a shortage of nurses. They love the idea of Kerala nurses who are educated, speak English as well as Malayalam, and who know their skills. And these nurses, unlike the ones who used to go to the Gulf, can go there, they can bring their families with them, they can get local residence permits, they can become citizens, and then they're no longer sending money back home to their family because their families are with them too. So that change in migration is something to watch out for. Kerala's migration story is changing from this kind of experience.
Just 10 years after British rule ended, the world's first democratically elected communist government, it was formed not in Russia, not in China, but in Kerala. Mm-hmm. How do you think that this bold political shift came about, Shashi?
A lot of factors. One certainly was social reform. The so-called lower caste, the underclass of society, got empowered. They got educated. They began to get exposed to these ideas. Secondly, Kerala, partially in the ferment of reform and partially because literacy came earlier in a larger number to the lower classes than in other states of India, became exposed to these radical ideas of communism faster than others. Now, I don't want to imply that others weren't. For example, Jawaharlal Nehru and his father traveled to the Soviet Union in the 1920s and they came back singing hosannas of praise for the Soviet model and socialism in Russia. So it's not that it was unknown, but in Kerala, somehow it captured the imagination much more quickly and it became a very quick mass movement. Even the reformed lower caste, for example, the Ujjava community, which used to be considered untouchable, today is called OBC, they became very strong backers of the communists because they had emerged from ages of discrimination into a world where they could actually hold their own, and they found the Communist Party a useful vehicle to advance their own socio-economic interests. That's just one example. This kind of thing meant that the communists became a viable force in Kerala, and they won that election in 1957.
In 1996, when the world was all about there's no alternative, Kerala launched People's Planning campaign saying, let people decide. Do you think this was a bold challenge to the colonial style rule?
Yeah, absolutely. There was no such equivalent in the British time. British rule was entirely top-down. I remember mentioning to you earlier that even the person who was the chief executive of a district was called the collector. His principal job was to collect revenue. That was why he was called the collector. So the whole British idea was top-down rule and extraction. And we inherited that system. And by and large, top-down rule and hierarchical governance was the norm. In the late 80s, Rajiv Gandhi talked about trying to expand Panchayati Raj, that is, grassroots village sabhas, village gram sabhas or village councils to represent the interests of the local people. That did not get as effectively implemented anywhere else as it did in Kerala. The Panchayati Raj amendments were passed, if I remember rightly, in 93 and 94. By 96, Kerala was already acting on them and giving budget and money to the gram sabhas, to the panchayats. So this is something that Kerala was quick off the mark because of all the reasons I mentioned to you.
Now, the Kudumbashree program, it grew out of the People's Planning and it basically built one of the world's largest women's collective, from running restaurants to factories even. Shashi, this powerhouse start, how? I mean, who gets credit for this?
Kudumbashree, I must admit, the first initial credit goes to the left governments, the communist-led governments. But it's been continued under all governments. I mean, as I say, in the last 55 years, except for the current term, there have been alternation of governments. But Kudumbashree has continued with the support of all governments. What Kudumbashree does is it essentially starts off as a kind of micro self-help group where literally 5 or 10 families of women will get together, discuss their problems, pool some little savings. Then there'll be assistance coming. Then 10, 15 of these micro groups become congregated together in a ward. Then 10, 15 of those in a larger administrative unit, etc. And then when you get to the more ambitious, bigger ventures, like as you mentioned, even businesses being run by them, the government's help and some financial support also becomes necessary. But what's happened with this women's help, self-help movement, it is, as you say, probably the largest single women's help movement in the world. I think it embraces millions of women. I don't want to give an exact number off the top of my head. Kerala has a total female population of just about 20 million. I would imagine that maybe half of them have either been in or still in Kudumbashree in some way or the other. And these women essentially come from fairly modest backgrounds, impoverished families or relatively formerly poor families. And they've used the Kudumbashree experience to both generate economic activity and thereby income for themselves, but also learn some empowerment. And government encouragement is necessary. So if you have, let's say, a public festival, an utsav, you may give the contract to Kudumbashree to do the catering for that, for example. Or run the ice cream stalls or have handicrafts in a fair. They do all of that stuff. And this, to my mind, is where you can say it is certainly grassroots empowerment of relatively modest income women, but with some active encouragement from the government. So you can't say it's not completely top down. It didn't all come from the bottom, but with encouragement from the top.
Kerala has handled health emergencies like Nipah and COVID better than many Western countries as well. Now, including the UK. What does this say about the lingering effects of Britain's own colonial public health legacy?
Look, the colonial healthcare system, frankly, in the British case, let's face it, public health was not a concern. health of their people in England meant that almost all the public healthcare expenditure was in fancy places in the cities, hospitals that British people could go to, clinics, and then, of course, private dispensaries, private doctors, private dentists, all of that also were flourishing under the British Raj. The villages were largely neglected. There were entire villages with no healthcare. Of course, we had traditional systems of medicine like Ayurveda, herbal treatments, and so on that survived in the villages. But frankly, it was looked down upon, thanks to the colonial attitude, it was looked down upon as a kind of inferior form of medicine, healthcare for people who couldn't afford the real healthcare of the British colonial system. Now, that has changed in Kerala. First of all, it's changed because of the fact that it's no longer just top-down. The every village now has a primary healthcare center or clinic, and every taluk, which is a unit below that of a district, will have a hospital. The district will certainly have a hospital. Public, I'm talking, in addition to whatever private people want to do. All of that helps. Plus, I mentioned to you, we have this strong, strong network of nursing education, medical education. So we have a strong healthcare provider system. We have become India's leading state in palliative care, where people dying of incurable illnesses like cancer can be treated at home and die amongst their loved ones with pain relief and so on, with healthcare workers visiting them in their homes to help them. That's something that happens in Kerala. You've got the ASHA workers, the sanitation hygiene workers who go from door to door, house to house, help people. Even during COVID, the ASHA workers are very, very important in outreach. So you've got an entire system that caters not to the urban elite, but to the poor and the rural and the simple people. Now, what's interesting is it coexists, because we are a democracy, it coexists with the private sector, but it's not enough. The Kerala miracle is all very well, but we need a thriving economy. We need businesses. We need factories. We need to generate jobs. And we're not doing enough of that, which is why our young people are flocking out for out-migration all the time. That's not a solution either.
When is that changing?
I think when we really have political leaders who are willing to come in with a vision to promote genuine ease of doing business slash regulation, encourage people to come and invest, and encourage workers to understand that demanding your rights is all very well, but if there are no investors coming, you can have rights in theory, you won't have jobs and salaries. Let's change that, and I think we can.
Kerala's literacy rate, high literacy rate, is often talked about, some 96% today. Yeah. But it's always been above average as compared to India, yeah, even during independence in 47. Does the credit go to the British?
Not at all. Zero. It credit goes to the social reform movements, which frankly were across all faiths. As I mentioned to you in another episode, there was social reform amongst the Christians, social reform amongst the various Hindu castes, and social reform even amongst the Muslims. So Kerala became a place where, for example, literacy and education was a sought-after objective. You've got a man like Sri Narayana Guru, who is not just a spiritual leader. He's not just fighting against caste discrimination. He's not just ensuring temples are open, but he's also preaching the virtues of education. He's telling his community, it's not just enough that you can go to a temple. It's not just enough that you can go and dine with somebody who's not of your caste. You've got to go to school. You've got to get an education. If you look at the census figures, the percentage of that community, the Ujjava community from which he came, that was literate in, say, the 1891 census would have been like 3%. By the 1921 census, the last one before he passed, it was already 27%. And the traditions that he'd started just kept on growing until Ujjavas, who were traditionally excluded from all this, became by themselves as literate a community as the upper caste communities. This was the sort of thing that happened across Kerala.
Kerala's also always pushed for decolonization in education as well. But what do you think about the NCERT changing school textbooks names from English to Hindi? This is something that Kerala has openly opposed.
Yeah, Kerala opposed it for logical reasons. Number one, they said if it's an English textbook, why can't it have an English name? So these were textbooks for very small kids, and they had names like, I don't know, Marigold and, you know, Bougainvillea and Rose or whatever, each, you know, so you graduated from a Marigold textbook to a Rose textbook to a Chrysanthemum textbook or whatever. And those have now been given Hindi names instead. Now, the Kerala Education Ministry has turned around and said, what sense does this make? The text of the book is in English. It's being taught in a state where the mother tongue is Malayalam. Why on earth do you want to have a Hindi name? And this is part of some of the sort of North Indian sort of blindness or deafness to the concerns of people in the South that people in places like Kerala and Tamil Nadu are quick to point out.
Can the Kerala model be implemented in other Indian states as well, given the fact that they have very different histories, very different challenges, but the same colonial past?
Very good question, to which I can't give you a simple answer. And it's also partially embedded in our constitution, because our constitution has a number of things that only state governments can do, and therefore the story will vary from state to state. Some that only the central government can do, and some where both can. This is what's called the concurrent list. So there are areas where some states could be helped by the center in some areas to make changes. And there are some places where the lead must be taken by the state. There's also a question of resources. It's not that some states are resistant to change, but that they don't generate enough tax revenue to finance some significant changes. So the answer is a complicated one. One thing I will say is we did inherit many, many problems as well as opportunities from what the British left us. I have been a strong critic of British colonialism, but I don't personally believe that we can blame everything on the British anymore, because we could have chosen not to continue some of these things. The fact that we took on the British educational system wholesale and didn't do enough to change it is our own fault. I remember saying as a student and writing, you know, before I came into politics, and certainly nothing to do with the present government and its politics, I said, why is it that I learned the classics of English literature, but never learned a word of Kalidasa? No one taught me the Mahabharata or the Ramayana. If I didn't have a grandmother or a mother who would tell me at home, would I have ever learned about this? Now, you can say, but you're going to an English medium school. Of course, you should learn Shakespeare and you should learn the Greek classics and so on. I say, fine, but Mahabharata and Ramayana and Kalidasa are also available in English translation. When do we decolonize our minds and impart to Indian students, even in the English medium schools, a sense of their own cultural heritage?
Dr. Shashi Tharoor, many thanks for your time.
Thank you, Ranjan. I've enjoyed the conversation. Take care.
So have I.
Decolonization is more than history. It's a learning, a constant process. Kerala showed us the way, but the journey is far from over. The future belongs to those who dare to rewrite the script.